Welcome to Three Associating.
One is the loneliest number.
A podcast that goes behind the door of therapists working in a relational psychoanalytic model. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Rachel. We're both therapists.
And we're both supervisees of Jill.
And I'm Jill, therapist and supervisor, and co-author with Jackie Winship of the book The Talking Cure.
While people might think that therapists have it all together, by now you know we don't. We get stuck, experience challenges, and have blind spots.
This continues to affect our work, and this is why we need ongoing supervision.
This podcast peeks behind the closed door of relational supervision and lets you know about the therapist's blind spots. Relational supervision complements the traditional focus on the patient by focusing on both patient and the therapist.
In each episode, we discuss a fictitious character in supervision. While none of these patients are real, the relational dynamics are.
Episode 7, Sex Talk. One is the loneliest number. Rach, if you had to choose, would you rather be good or would you rather be fun?
I'm not sure how much choice I have in the matter, but let's just go with wholesome fun.
Good choice. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Andy.
So I'm bringing in a patient today who I'll name Scott, who's in his mid-50s, and I've seen him once a week for the last 6 months. He is an accountant, and he's very successful and wealthy and intelligent, and he's come to therapy for a few reasons. Firstly, he would like to find a long-term relationship. He's had a number of friends, has a number of friends, but he's never been in a long-term relationship. He also has trouble with decision-making, so he talks about really agonizing about having to make decisions, and he'll often make extensive pros and cons lists and elaborate spreadsheets, and he sort of organizes and reorganizes information, but really puts off having to make a decision. Even like when his Christmas holidays are coming up, he'll make a spreadsheet of who he's going to see when and that sort of thing. Yeah, really has trouble with decision-making. And he mentioned this in passing, but I think it's sort of actually central to why he's seeking therapy. He said he doesn't feel much. And he said, I mean, I get emotions like conceptually, if you know what I mean, which I thought was an interesting way of describing it. And he said, you know, I've worked hard and I want to be able to enjoy things. And I do things that I think I enjoy, but I don't sort of feel the enjoyment. I feel very fondly towards him. And I'd say he's one of the most earnest people I've ever met. So he's very sincere. He's a very sort of good guy. Like he really prides himself on being good. He's a sort of person you'd really like to have as a neighbor because he'd be very considerate. He really loves following rules and he loves everything being in its right place. He's very immaculately presented. And it took me a while to really understand this in him. Like when we first met for our initial session, he asked me what the rules of therapy were. And I said that I prefer to think of the parameters that govern therapy as like a set of mutual agreements rather than rules that are sort of imposed by me. And he said, totally deadpan, he said, well, that's good for you, but what are the rules? And I laughed because I thought it was a joke. And he said, what's so funny? And I said, oh, I thought you were making a joke about the rules. And he said, why would I joke about rules? And I laughed again because I thought he was joking and he wasn't. And so we've got a very different sense of humor, so it's taken us a while to find our groove. But yeah, he's got a real passion for fairness and he believes that order and rules ensure fairness and equality. And often his trouble with decision-making arises from there not being a rule around what he should do. He grew up in a family where his parents and especially his father really heavily favored his older brother. He's just one of two siblings. And we've talked a bit about how Scott's sense of missing out on things when he was growing up and just the inequality in his household has really shaped his love of fairness and order. We've developed a good rapport over our time working together, but I'm struck by how affectless and humorless our work is. So often I'll use humor in the work just because it feels pretty natural for me, but it doesn't really work with Scott and his humor doesn't quite work with me. We sort of have that mismatch that we had in the first session. So
does he bring humor that he hopes you'll get?
Yes, but it will sort of be like the reverse of what happened in that initial session. So he will bring something up and I will think he's being serious and I won't laugh, and then he'll be waiting for me to laugh, but I'll have missed that it's a joke because it doesn't seem funny to me. So there's a real hit and miss with, well, no, not hit and miss. There's just miss with the humour at this stage.
Do you have an example or not really, Andy?
There was something, it was around rules. I can't quite remember it specifically, but there was something where something was out of order in a way in which he felt was absurd. And he thought that was funny. It was to do with, there was some signage at the shops, and basically the way in which this display was arranged didn't match the signage. I didn't quite get it. He told me about it, and I sort of thought he was irritated by this thing being different to how it should be. But he was telling it to me because he found it amusing, but I missed it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, our connection really comes through intellect. So we have like a strong intellectual connection, and I feel like all of our work is engaging on an intellectual level, but then we're really kind of stuck in that realm. Mm. And Scott keeps asking me when we're going to get to feeling. And I keep saying, let's keep talking and see what happens, because I feel like you can't force it. But it doesn't feel like feeling is going to creep in anytime soon.
Mm.
We've covered lots of different areas of his life, from like family history, relationships, interests, grief and loss. But everything is described by him in this same sort of even-handed, intellectual, detached way. Even sex, like when he talks about his sex life, it's very organized and kind of methodical. And we've talked about this, like he knows it. So the closest thing I've seen to him sort of have a strong feeling was when he sat down on the lounge one day and he had this pristine white shirt on and his elbow leaned against a new pillow and some of the dye rubbed off on the elbow. And he clocked it and looked at it, and he had a look of sort of irritation go across his face. And he said, oh, bother. And then talked about trying to work out what laundry liquid to use to remove the stain. Like, that's it. So, getting to know him, I think I understand why he's had trouble finding a long-term relationship, because he's so good and he's so likable, but he's also quite lifeless.
Mm-hmm.
And he's aware of this, and he's aware that it's an issue. Mm. And he said that one night about 10 years ago, after a friend of his had too many wines, his friend said to him, Scott, you're such a good guy, but you're not very fun. And that comment really stuck with Scott and resonated with him. And it resonates with my experience of him as well, that he's not much fun. And I've been trying to work out how to sort of help him with this in ways that might involve connecting to feeling.
Yeah.
And something interesting happened a few sessions ago that feels like an opening that I'm sort of wanting help with, I guess. Over the course of our conversation, I can't remember what we were talking about, but his friend's comment about him being a good guy but not much fun came to my mind, and I just brought it up to him again. And he sort of looked away quickly and then brought his eye contact back, and I just asked him where his mind went. And he said he was thinking about what had occurred after his friend had made that comment. And I asked him about this, and he said he didn't really want to talk about it because it felt very out of character for him, which almost felt like some sort of shame, which is like, okay, there's something there. And when he mentioned this, it was like something came alive in the room a bit. So I pressed him on it. And he said that his friend's comment had hit a bit of a nerve, and he realized that he didn't want to die being remembered as a good guy who wasn't very fun. And he'd heard this friend talk about traveling to Berlin and having fun in the club scene there. And so he impulsively bought a return ticket to Berlin, which he said was really out of, and it is really out of character for him. He said, I didn't let myself think about it. I just
did it
straight to Berlin. And then he told me about this experience where he went to Berlin and he basically partied nonstop for 2 weeks. So he took heaps of drugs. He had lots of sex with lots of different guys. He basically hung out in the club scene and, according to him, went nuts. When he was talking about this, though, it's like his eyes lit up. And I said something like, oh, it sounds like perhaps you're enjoying yourself, because enjoyment is such a, or lack of enjoyment is such a thing for him. And he said, yeah, but I think I OD'd on enjoyment. It just wasn't for me. And I asked him what he meant by that. And he said that towards the end of the trip, in his words, he wasn't doing so well. And he actually ended up having to be hospitalized because he said that I'd lost my mind and I didn't know who I was anymore or where I was in the world. So from what he described, it sort of sounds like he experienced like a drug-induced psychosis or a sleep deprivation-induced psychosis or some kind of snap out of reality. He was released from hospital after a couple of days. He flew back to Sydney and he said that he returned home and wanted to forget about the experience. And so we've been exploring the experience for the last few weeks, but it just hasn't felt the same as when he first mentioned it in session.
Yes.
And it feels as though we're kind of intellectually dissecting what happened for him. But that sense of aliveness that was in the room that he initially mentioned has disappeared. And I want to get back there, but I'm not sure how. And that's where I find myself stuck today.
Golly, that's quite intriguing.
Yeah. Mm.
But how do you feel? I know you feel very fond of him, and I also know you've got a meeting of minds. But beyond that, how do you feel in the room with him in the session that isn't such fun?
Yeah, that's a good question. How do I feel? I don't know if I feel much in the session with him, which I think is sort of telling. Mm. I feel, like I said, I feel kind of stimulated intellectually and engaged in that way.
Mm.
And yeah, like I have a feeling of warmth and fondness towards him. But yeah, it's hard to feel much in session with him. I felt more when he disclosed about that experience than I had a sense of something came alive. But yeah, it's hard to feel much with him.
Do you feel a bit dead yourself in the sessions or not really? Because it doesn't sound like you feel, you know, bored out of your mind or present.
Yeah, I don't feel bored or not present. I think the best way to describe it would be I feel a bit 2D. You know, it's like there's a dimension of experience that's missing.
Mm. Yes.
And it's a little bit like knowing someone in person and then having a Zoom with them and feeling like, well, this is sort of the same, but it's missing something. That would be the quality of my experience with him.
Well, I'm not sure how you can get unstuck. That I'm not sure of, because it does seem quite an intractable problem. And it is interesting that he hasn't had a relationship and he's sort of 50-ish. Why I asked the question, do you feel dead? Because Lacan always says that the best therapist for an obsessional person is a dead therapist. So that's why I ask. And he does sound, you know, I don't like labels, but he does sound toward that with the spreadsheets. But it feels to me, you know, because you don't feel that so much in the session, it feels to me more that he doesn't know how to be in life. It's paint by numbers.
Yeah.
Like I do my holiday with the paint by numbers. Then I know that a friend of mine had fun, so now I'm going to have fun.
Yeah.
Paint by numbers. And I go to Berlin and I get involved in all of this, and then I have a psychotic break.
Right.
And again, I can't help but think of him more from a Lacanian point of view, actually, Andy, that things of the body are too alive for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm really curious about sex, because often sex can break through that. You know, does he have sex off drugs in his normal situation in Sydney, not Berlin?
Yes.
So he does. And does he have a lot of it or very seldom?
He has very regular sex. So there's a few different guys who he sleeps with regularly, but it's very scheduled. There's like the Monday guy and like the Thursday guy, like every second Sunday afternoon guy. So it's like slotted in.
And these guys are not paid. They're not escorts. They're actually friends.
Yeah, not as far benefits. As I know. Yeah.
Friends with benefits, yeah. Yes, but you see, he's taken out the disrupting effect that sex can have in a good way, because it disrupts something.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about that. And I actually think that the things of the body are a big problem to him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the closest he got to getting irritated was when there was a stain on the shirt.
Right.
But I would be curious to pursue that line of inquiry more.
Huh.
Around sexuality, interestingly, because I think sexuality is usually for most people in the beginning, yes, they can settle into domestic relationships where it can take on a regularity and, you know, as Esther Perel says, mating in captivity can sometimes lack the fun factor and you have to work on it. But he seems to be lacking the fun factor, although he is in a bit of captivity, isn't he? Monday night, Wednesday night, every second.
Right, right.
So he's doing everything in the captivity of his own mind. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Then I also found it fascinating that the symptom is actually procrastination, or he can't kind of make up his mind or commit, because that's about interrupting yourself.
Right.
So there's something about not being in the free flow of sex, in the free flow of the relationship with you, and not being in, you know, the free flow of his life. So let me not say more at this moment. Let me rather hear from you. But that's where my thought goes, which I'm struck, are intellectual thoughts.
Right. Parallel.
So the problem is the problem is the problem.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm in good company with that, because that's what I feel happens with me when I'm working with him.
Yes.
What you were saying before about the sort of disruption and sort of obstructing that, I guess. I mean, I'm thinking too with his sexual encounters. Again, I want to ask more about them now that we're having this discussion. But my impression too is that he will not be, well, he tends to be submissive and tends to be following the rules that the other person sets. At least the impression that I get is in these encounters, they're sort of constructed so that there's not much room for spontaneity or for, you know, it's like, this is what the other person wants. These are the other person's rules that you play by. And they might be being spontaneous, but he is just following their lead, so to speak. And he likes that because it's good.
Because you see, I would definitely go into that and I'd be really interested in his first sexual experience, you know, how he came upon masturbation, all of that without sort of getting intrusive. But
yeah.
I do think a sexual history would be really important, and how he heard about it, who spoke to him about it. Why I'm focused there is not out of some pure curiosity, but I am trying to go into the one area which sometimes we can't control.
Yeah.
And he's putting a huge amount of energy into controlling it. Then I would be interested, are the sexual scene scenarios where he plays out certain roles, because you're saying he follows certain rules.
Yeah.
So, you know, what kind of scenario is being played out? Because often we can get from that, the scenario, not the sex as such, but the scenario. Yeah. What is it that he's trying to engage with, puzzle over, avoid, control, all the above? So not sure how helpful that is to Andy, but that's where I would go. Obviously, delicately, we're not going to go like a bull in the china shop. Otherwise, he might think you're not following the rules of decorum. But that would be interesting.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. So my mind goes to two places when you say that. One is, I think there's something about pursuing that and pursuing it a bit more than I have been that would potentially feel disruptive to the pattern that we're in a healthy way or a good way. I was also just thinking, as you were talking about kind of his sex life, I was also thinking about, and the body, I was thinking about his relationship to food as well, because he has a really, he goes on all these different like diets and different, he's always sort of looking at like micronutrients and macronutrients. And it's really, it's like this whole equation for how to engineer his body.
That doesn't surprise me at all. And, you know, it really doesn't. And then actually the terror that when he did let go, which he did paint by numbers, but he took all these drugs and he really had a psychotic break.
Yeah.
So there's something very, very important in that, in the all or nothing quality of it.
Right.
That it's not graded, it's all or nothing.
Right.
But yes, that's what I'm hoping, is that by introducing the topics, you'll be breaking the rules of therapy as he's constructed them in his head little bit. I mean, we obviously don't want to be transgressive and cross boundaries, but, you know, just you're disrupting something a little bit to get out of what feels to me the rigidity of what he's imposing on himself.
Yeah.
And the therapy, and to then see what might happen.
Yeah, I like that idea. I feel like for me there's something about humour that can disrupt, and I feel like there's something interesting about our humour being mismatched.
Mm.
It's like it disrupts things, but not in a useful – it just feels like it's a miss.
Yes, because it's interfering with the connection rather than disrupting something in a way that opens up thought, because it is a mismatch, and a mismatch – you know, can sometimes lead to something creative, but more often than not, which is your experience of it, the mismatch in the humor is actually not being helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's an interference, not a disruption. Yeah. Mm.
But I think you're actually interrupting the fact that you're an intellectual partner.
Yeah.
To suddenly be thinking about things of the body and sexuality, of course, in an appropriate way, obviously, but you'll be breaking a pattern of how you and he relate, and hopefully opening up more relational degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you're trying to do anyway. And perhaps in a titrated way, he can start thinking about things that are disruptive rather than going off to Berlin and taking heaps of drugs, partying, and landing up, you know, in a hospital, which is so extreme.
So extreme. And even that felt so regulated, right? It's like, I'm having fun, so I will go and do this for 7 days.
Yeah, pain, you know, as I say, pain panama. So there's something that he's terrified about, the spontaneity and the free flow of his own juices, so to speak, all kinds of juices, you know, the food, the this, the that. And he's terrified of the free flow of a relationship, which is why it's so hard for him to be in one.
Yeah.
So we're toward the end, Andy, so we might have to interrupt ourselves, but I hope enough has flowed for you to have some sense of where you might go.
Yeah, I think it has. It's it's been useful to think about, and I just have this other memory.
Yes.
I don't know if we've got time or not.
No, but just we've got 2 minutes.
Quickly. Yeah, this other memory just came back of, there was one session when he came in the door and I went to get a glass to pour him water. So my hand sort of went out, and I think he thought I was trying to like shake his hand or trying to like touch him on the arm or something. Anyway, he sort of thought that I was sort of coming for him in a way.
Yes.
He like did almost like this matrix, like kind of trying to dodge the physical contact.
Yes.
And I just thought of that then in terms of body stuff and discomfort with body stuff. And because, yeah, I was just going for the glass, but it was like I'd reached out to him and he was so uncomfortable with that.
But it's a beautiful metaphor, isn't it? That in all kinds of ways he dodges contact.
Right, right.
Including contact with himself. And that's what we're trying now, to see if we can intervene somehow to get him in contact.
Yeah. Thanks, Jill.
So just the last thing I'd say, because when I said get him in contact, just be on the whole idea of attacks on linking, to try to get some linking going between body and mind. And between affect and intellect, but as we both know, easier said than done. But perhaps we leave it there.
Easier said than done, but I like that, because I think I'm going to be on the lookout now for more openings in terms of making those links with the body, and now that I can think of more now in retrospect.
Okay, so, good.
Yeah, it's useful. Thanks, Jill.
Now we reflect on what happened. We identified the dilemma we took into the supervision, the distillation we took out of supervision, and our blind spots.
Blind spots include bright spots and dark spots. A bright spot is when we are blinded to the overall picture and we can only see a sliver of what is occurring in ourselves and in the interaction. A dark spot is when the issues are more completely out of sight. Okay, Andy, what was your dilemma going into this supervision session?
Yeah, I think it was pretty simple. I think it was, how do we breathe some more life into the therapy?
Yeah, yeah. And what was your distillation?
What I took away was that I needed to disrupt Scott's preferred mode of communication, which was intellectualization, by moving toward talking about the body and, for Scott, sex as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so blind spots. Jill, what was the bright spot?
Well, Andy, I thought perhaps you were a bit seduced by the pleasures of the mind. Which
never,
can
me.
Be, which can indeed be very enjoyable. But I think that because of that, while you did know at one level that you were stuck, because you brought it because you felt stuck, at another level you couldn't quite abstract yourself from the pleasure sufficiently to become unstuck.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what was the dark spot?
Well, I think the dark spot was that there was a consistency between Scott's preferred mode of defending, which was intellectualization, and what, as you laughed, Andy, and indeed true, what I've come to know of you, that you also have at least one of your defenses as a preferred mode is intellectualization.
You have others.
And I think that consistency or concordance led to you being blinded to the degree of co-construction that might be operating between you and Scott.
Mm.
So what were your learning points, Andy?
My first learning point was around the importance of disrupting stereotype patterns of communication in the room, no matter what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the second learning point was that a good way to bring life and spontaneity into the room is to engage with the libido of the patient, which could mean talking about sex or food or drugs or sort of like the ways in which someone plays, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what were the teaching points, Jill?
Well, again, I thought it could be helpful to shine a light with the patient as not shining the light. So Scott focuses, as we know, not only on the intellect but also on rules and the social contract. And I felt that from a Lacanian point of view, we do have rules and social contract, but counterposed to that is the body and the drives and how we engage with the body and the drive. So again, I would have perhaps tried to bring that into the picture. Sticking with the Lacanian point of view, because I did feel it was helpful in thinking about Scott, I think people have difficulty with their bodies, and I think he does because he needs to control so much, you know, regular and regulated sex, the food, everything. I think that people who over-control in that way at a deep level have an awareness that there is something threatening and that they could actually have a psychotic break, which in fact he did have, if they were to not be so mindful about thinking about how to be in the social contract and in the world in a particular way. So I would keep that in mind as a teaching point, because you don't want to bludgeon through the defences, even as we're saying, shine the light somewhere else. And then just a third point to keep in mind, Bjorn's invocation that we should focus on linking.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a final question for Jill about Scott?
Yeah, so I guess given this patient's dynamic, how useful, Jill, do you think that talk therapy is for Scott? Like, I'm wondering if you might be better off working in a somatic psychotherapy or at least in a mode of therapy that doesn't privilege language quite so highly.
Well, I think I wouldn't get into the binary because, again, I think we're repeating something about a split. I think the talking cure is very helpful to him and having a framework to think about things, but I might add something. So, and the thing that sprang to mind was holotropic breathing, because I believe that that has been found helpful in disrupting customary filters. And it would give him perhaps some of the Berlin experience, which he was seeking. We have to bear in mind that he's seeking something, but he could do it in a more titrated way, in a way over which he had more control. So I do think that alternative methods would be helpful for him. But carefully applied, and all the more reason, therefore, to be three associating.
Thank you for listening to Three Associating. Our theme song is performed by Katie Whiten, and our audio production is by Jared Young. So a big thank you to both Katie and Jared. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating and review on whichever platform you listen to us. We love hearing from you and appreciate all of the support we've had so far. This really helps us to continue to make new content.
Bye for now. What is the loneliest number one?